Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Força Armada assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
Want to be nasty? Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país, tá? Nada, absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome back to Season 2 of PALcast, a podcast by the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or PAL. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. PAL is an academic endeavor where we seek to understand how law is used by rising autocrats to consolidate power or by those who are trying to resist those moves. You can learn more about the project at autocratic-legalism.net. In the last two episodes of this season, I'm interviewing two students who were engaged with PAL and the themes we are exploring through the project. Today I talk to Sofia Rolim, a master's student at FGV Law School in São Paulo, Brazil, one of the main institutions behind the PAL project. At FGV, Sofia took a seminar on autocratic legalism led by my colleagues and PAL researchers Marta Machado and Raquel Pimenta. In that course, students read a series of works in progress, which looked at the changes Brazil was going through under the still president Jair Bolsonaro and the ways in which Bolsonaro was making use of law to promote those changes. Those studies are soon going to be published in a book, which I look forward to reviewing here on the podcast with the editors and authors. Sofia also became a graduate research assistant, helping with the editorial work needed for that book, as well as with some of the organizing work needed for PAL in general, and we are very thankful for her support. Sofia's own studies focus on Bolsonaro's policies in public safety, which, as listeners may know, has led to an increase in police violence and access to firearms. In this episode, we draw from Sofia's organizing and intellectual work in PAL to reflect upon the issues we always reflect upon on the podcast, that is, what is happening to democracy and what law has to do with it. You will listen to the interview after a brief word from our sponsors.
My name is Scott Fritzen, Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, which is a proud sponsor of this podcast and the institutional home of its host, Professor Desai Silva. CIS offers numerous majors and minors related to international and area studies, a flagship master's in international studies, a fully online master's in global affairs, and 9 research centers, including the Center for Brazil Studies. Learn more about how we promote global fluency at ou.edu/CIS.
Sofia Rolim, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Fabio.
This past year, as part of your master's program at Direito GV São Paulo, or the FGV Law School in São Paulo, you took a course on autocratic legalism, and you became a graduate research assistant in the PAL project. Where does your interest in issues of democracy and the rule of law come from?
Right when I started university and started studying law, I joined a research group on transitional justice in Brazil. I had this big interest in studying more about what had happened during the military dictatorship in the country, and I found the debate around the legacies of that period to our present-day institutions to be really intriguing and really relevant. So probably the first book that I read as a law student was Antony Pereira's Political Injustice, Authoritarianism and the Rule of Law, which of course brings this really rich account of the way in which the military regimes in Brazil, Argentina, and Chile made the effort to act within the limits of law and, you know, what were the consequences of that. And I think that's a really amazing book for students in the beginning of their legal training because it just shows you from the start how law can be used for authoritarian purposes and that legality is not equal to something being just or legitimate, not necessarily. And then something else, which I think was relevant for me personally, was that, I started my bachelor's degree in law in 2013, which was, of course, a really intense year in Brazilian politics because of the very large nationwide protests, the popular demonstrations, which were prompted by fare hikes in public transport and also encompassed grievances over the excessive public spending and rights violations related to the hosting of the 2014 World Cup. And they also put forward this deeper criticism and discontent with representative democracy and its shortcomings. And for me, it was a really striking experience to take part in those demonstrations and to kind of see firsthand the kind of social mobilization that was taking place and that was growing and changing and trying to resist co-opting and all that. So that was a very formative experience for me politically. And then, of course, I was also following up on the processes of criminalization of the activists and organizers that started to take place. And at that time, we had Dilma Rousseff as a president, who is someone who fought the armed struggle against the military dictatorship, who was imprisoned, who was tortured. And there were very, very important advances in terms of transitional justice during her term. The Truth Commission was created and all that. And that was the kind of thing that I was studying in this research group on transitional justice. But at that point, the federal government also played a very important role in the repression of the 2013-2014 demonstrations. There's this one activist that recalls an official statement that Dilma gave on TV saying that, unlike in her youth, where she was sent to prison, nowadays in Brazil, no one was persecuted for manifesting their political opinion anymore. And he recalls watching that from his prison cell, where he was sent to under the allegations that the social movement he was a part of was actually a criminal organization. So, and there's this very clear element of political persecution of anti-communist, anti-anarchist sentiments in the trials of these social movement organizers that were criminalized because of 2013-2014 protests. So I think that contradiction, you know, the complexity of that debate, I think is what really consolidated my interest in these issues of democracy and the use of law for authoritarian purposes, and which led me later to pursue my master's at FGV and eventually join the PAL project.
And how did the course and all the work that you did as a graduate research assistant in the project help you better understand issues of democracy and the rule of law in general, as well as in Brazil?
I think that the PAL project really engages with the complexity of analyzing the authoritarian advances of Bolsonaro in this context, in which there was never a high intensity democracy to begin with. So a very large percentage of the Brazilian population already lived without accessing basic public services and completely excluded from any kind of political participation way before Bolsonaro was elected. And it's definitely much more challenging to identify and analyze the authoritarian advances under these circumstances. And I think that also raises some very important theoretical questions on democracy and rule of law and on the shortcomings of the liberal democracy paradigm, and also, you know, on the issues that were faced and on the shortcomings of these regimes that we understood as democratic, but that somehow led to the rise of these authoritarian leaders. And Paul has definitely introduced me to extremely interesting research and debates on the legal tools mobilized in different forms of resistance to these authoritarian advances. So to say that the counter-hegemonic uses of law, and having that understanding that law is, this tool that can be used on behalf of whatever political project, I think is relevant, you know, not just to understand that law and justice aren't the same, but that it's not inherently bad or hegemonic either, that there are these possibilities of resistance within these legal frameworks that can be crucial in times of democratic decline. So Paul has definitely helped me identify other new ways in which legal tools play a role in enabling or preventing authoritarianism. I think that has led me to a different understanding of law and definitely to this non-essentialist view on law. That's something really important that I feel that I've also gained. And I also feel that there have been a lot of really interesting conversations that I have had with other graduate students at FGV, people who are not part of the project, but that have read Shapley's article on autocratic legalism or other papers from researchers at the PAL project and have become familiarized with the concept because of maybe events that we organized or because of the graduate course even. And then they have started to think about how this idea of autocratic legalism plays out in their own research topics independently. And they have come to really interesting conclusions. So I think that the way the discussion on autocratic legalism has really spread in the graduate program here and has led a lot of people to start thinking about it on their own, that has led to very, you know, generative discussions and insights from a lot of very different perspectives and topics. That has been really, really interesting for me.
As part of this course that you took, you wrote a paper that looks at the relationship between law and democratic backsliding in the more specific field of public safety. And it's a paper that's going to be published in a book that brings together all the other papers that were produced by students who took the course, which is something very interesting in its own right. Why don't you share with us the conclusions that you came to in that study?
Sure. So basically what I do in this paper that I've written is to analyze what I identified as the two main propositions in the field of public safety in the Bolsonaro administration. And that's the so-called illicitness excludent project. So attempts to pass legislation which makes acts of violence committed by the police and the military legal by default. And the arms promotion policy, which aims to increase access of the populations to guns through the dismantling of gun control legislation and other kinds of legal incentives. With the illicitness excluded, I understand that the proposal unfolds through two ways. So first, through the attempt of actually changing legislation, of altering the Brazilian Penal Code in order to prevent even, you know, the smallest possibility of responsabilization or accountability of security force agents involved in the killings of civilians. And secondly, through the discursive investments that Bolsonaro makes in his explicit defense of police violence and killing of civilians. So when Bolsonaro, while he has been unable to approve any of the two bills of law that he presented to Congress, he didn't manage to pass them. I understand that this represents only a partial failure in the accomplishment of his goals, because although the legislation remains the same, well, one, it's under this same legislation that the near absolute impunity for police officers has become systematic and normalized. So his intention is not really to transform anything, but rather to further consolidate this reality. And two, his speech produces relevant symbolic effects that help him advance his goals. And this affects not only the security agents, who may feel even more empowered and legitimized to act in this violent and belligerent way, but also it produces effects on the population in general, who is impacted by this normalization of such an absurd level of state violence. So I understand that through para-institutional acts such as speech, he has partially accomplished his goal of expanding police violence and impunity. And on the other hand, Bolsonaro has, you know, by any standard, been very successful in his arms promotion policy. We have in Brazil an important gun control legislation called the Disarmament Statute, and Bolsonaro has chosen to try and dismantle it while bypassing Congress. He has passed an enormous amount of decrees and ordinances, which have, first of all, loosened the restrictions on possession and carrying of weapons. And secondly, they have made the rules on this topic very confusing at times, because there were so many new rules that were vague or that contradicted each other or that were suspended by the judiciary, and that made the activity of controlling, you know, which weapons someone can or can't possess at a given moment much, much trickier, because it was just basically so hard to keep up with all the new legislation. And this combines with this discursive investment that equates the possession of guns with safety, and that very explicitly incentives people to arm themselves. And the controls on the amount and the type of guns which people are now allowed to have, that has also been loosened to an extreme, especially if you register as a hunter, collector, or sports shooter, which is now a really, really easy thing to do. And the data on the increase of gun possession is appalling. It's really impressive. And not to bore you with a bunch of numbers, but just to illustrate, in 2018, there were 120,000 hunters, collectors, and sports shooters registered in Brazil. And in March 2022, that figure was already over 670,000 people. And that's larger than our contingent of military police officers and larger than the army as well. And the fact that now this category can buy large amounts of very heavy weaponry, you know, the type of weapons that were previously of restricted use only for the security forces, that makes it really attractive to people who want to use these weapons for other less legitimate purposes. A few weeks ago, there was this really big weapon apprehension, including rifles and machine guns, at the hands of people that are allegedly linked to one of the main criminal gangs dealing in drug trafficking in Brazil. And all of the guns were legal. They were registered under someone else's name, of course, but it really shows how this hunter sports shooter category really facilitates this type of access. So in that sense, my findings are very aligned with what other researchers from POW Project have concluded in other fields of public policy, and with what professors Oscar Vilhena, Rubens Gleiser, and Ana Laura Barbosa have described as authoritarian infralegalism, which is this concept that points to the relevance of infralegal instruments such as decrees and interministerial ordinances, all things that Bolsonaro can issue on his own without congressional approval, as well as of para-institutional instruments to the advance of authoritarianism in the Brazilian context. And I think we can see that playing out in the public safety field very clearly as well.
And this is the kind of finding that is providing a key contribution to studies on autocratic legalism. The seminal studies on this issue were more concerned with legal change that was being promoted, with constitutional amendments or replacements or bills that autocrats were managing to pass through Congress to make their legal systems manipulable. What studies like yours are showing is that sometimes they don't even need to pass new laws. They can work with the laws that exist. They can tweak these laws to achieve the exact opposite of what these laws were designed for. And they can even claim that they were just enforcing the law, that they are enforcing the will of Congress. So Congress says, no broad access to firearms. Hunters and shooters are an exception, and the executive comes in, tweaks the criteria and the procedures for somebody to register as a hunter or shooter, and boom, the next day you have thousands showing up as hunters or shooters, and you have broad access to firearms, which is exactly what the law, as you mentioned, was intending to prevent. How does your research help us better understand these tactics, which, as I said, differ from others that had been documented in the past?
I think that what we're looking at here is this alliance between these tweaks in law, like you mentioned, but also on this investment on cultural change, really. And that's where speech comes in, because I feel that with the registration as a hunter or a sports shooter, or even if you're registering for acquiring a legal firearm, but not in that category, it was harder before. He really loosened the legislation and the control, but it wasn't extremely hard to do that before either. Maybe you had to take a couple more tests, exams, a psychological exam, which now is no longer required in the same sense. You had to go through a few more bureaucratic steps, but you could still do it. And people didn't do it as much because we didn't have a president that was talking about it all the time. Because when it was National Farmers Day, we had pictures of people farming and we had tomatoes and lettuces in the photo with the farmers. And now you have a farmer carrying a rifle. You know, that's the representation that SECOM, the Institutional Communications Office under Bolsonaro, chose for that day. So you have this really, really big semiotic investment even in promotion of arms and on equating having a gun with being safe, with protecting your property, with protecting your family. And then you have these little tweaks in law which make it much easier. But it's not just that. And I think that when we look at the hunter, sports shooter, collector category, it that makes it even more clear, because there's this huge jump from the moment Bolsonaro is elected onwards. But actually, that number starts to increase in 2016, which is the moment of the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff and the moment that Bolsonaro starts gaining protagonism, and people start saying maybe Bolsonaro could be president, and that very fringe moment movement starts, you know, gaining protagonism and growing. So before 2016, I think there were like 10,000 CACs, which is the hunter, sports shooters, collectors. 10,000 is nothing. And then when Bolsonaro comes to power, that's already 100-something thousand, and then now it's more people than the military, more people than the army, than the military police. So you have this parallel army, in a sense, right, that can access basically the same amount, the same kind of weapon that the security force agents. So I think it's really the combination of these two things. And that's what's so frightening about it. I mean, so terrifying, because when Bolsonaro is no longer in office, and hopefully that will be sooner rather than later, but we can change the law back to what it was, we can add more bureaucratic steps, but I mean, the impact of that investment in this change of culture and mentality, that's much, much harder to turn back, right?
As somebody who has a foot in legal consciousness scholarship and cultural studies of law, I can't agree enough with you. I think it's really important for us to look at how these leaders are altering the cultural fabric of societies against which we make sense of law, of what is prohibited and what is allowed. I wanted to change the direction of our conversation here, though, and think in more optimistic terms. I agree with your observation in response to my first question that public safety in contemporary Brazil was never fully consistent with liberal democracy. And I obviously agree with your analysis that subverting the law as he did, Bolsonaro made things worse. But let's assume that he loses the election this year and somebody comes in with the intent to change things for better. Can the law play any role in facilitating those changes?
I think law can play a number of roles in changing this for the better, but I wanted to highlight one of these roles, which is cutting back on criminal law. So revoking laws that criminalize conduct such as drug trafficking, you know, decriminalizing drugs would have a huge impact in reducing mass incarceration, and directing the economic benefits of that process is to people from the communities that suffer the most with the repression from the war on drugs. That would be an important step towards reparation. Cutting back on legislations that are used to criminalize protest and social movement and dissent. So I'm talking about the national security law, the anti-terrorism law, the criminal association law. These are all extremely broad legislations that don't offer any kind of a solution to the social problems that they were supposed to be helping with. And they exist so that they can be applied selectively, so that they can be mobilized to incarcerate whatever group is seen as undesirable at any given moment. And they're illegitimate, they're authoritarian, and they should be revoked. I think we should be using the law to end mass incarceration, to end the normalization of imprisonment as a reasonable response to social problems. What we see nowadays is this resort to criminal law and to criminalization as the go-to solution for any kind of social problem. And I think we need to fight that, not only because it's super ineffective, you know, criminalization does not solve basically any of the problems that it sets out to solve, but also because this prevents us from coming up with and implementing other kinds of solutions. So this equation where justice equals punishment equals carceral punishment, when this gets this embedded in our mentality as a society, this prevents us from advancing other possibilities, from being creative and developing alternatives which don't resort to incarceration and policing and punishment and violence as a response. And the way in which law has been mobilized has definitely played a big role in strengthening this kind of mentality. And parallel to that, I think we just really need to cut back on policing. And that involves several legal issues, beginning with the fact that our current model for policing is established in the Constitution. But all legislation that expands the power of law enforcement, we should be looking at it to abolish it. And so I'm thinking about, you know, the recent constitutional amendment that creates the penal police and so turns prison guards into police officers, the provisions for guarantee of law and order, military operations, attempts such as the one by Bolsonaro with the illicitness excluding project, the criminal organizations law when it allows for police to make requests directly to the judge in criminal procedure instead of having to go through the public prosecutor's office. So that kind of legislation, which increases the power of the police and widens this margin of non-accountability for police officers, all of that must go. And any legal change aimed at reforming the police should be oriented towards a goal of reducing the scale of policing and redirecting those funds and resources to other measures which are actually effective at reducing violence and criminality, you know, instead of creating them. I think that would be a really huge contribution from law, and we should be looking at that in more detail.
Before I let you go, I wanted to hear some tips you might have to students who might be in college thinking about going to grad school and studying issues of law, democratic backsliding, or students who are already maybe in a graduate program who are developing an interest in these things. What do you recommend that they read or that they follow or that they engage with somehow?
Okay, so this is a really cool question. I think that instead of recommending literature, I think I'm gonna point out a couple of challenges, which I think we're all facing and that we all need to engage with these challenges, not just students that are starting to research this now, but I think, you know, it's going to be up to maybe a new generation to really create the theoretical developments that we need in this. But it's basically the issue that, you know, there are these really relevant contemporary challenges that we're facing that are not really contemplated in classical theories of democracy. And I think that maybe the number one issue is climate change. It's usually something that we think about separate from the idea of democracy. And when we're saying we're defending democracy and saying that that's the best system of government, the best political system, most theories and most authors that have written on this are not considering that a criteria for democracy should be, is this regime capable of ensuring our survival as a species? And, you know, if we can't have that, is it really that important that we're discussing about the tweaking of the law here or that if we're not going to be able to live, inhabit in this planet? So I think we need to make these two issues, you know, compatible and try to understand them as a whole and to think of democracy as a system that can deal with the most important issues that we're facing at this time. And I think also the issue of climate emergency and climate justice really makes it clear that the answer has to be global. We can't think of answers that are limited to the borders of our regions or our nations anymore. We never could, but now I think that that's abundantly clear because we really need to engage with the context and the challenges of other countries and regions, because the challenge that we have ahead of us is to produce answers to a really systemic global level problem that can only be responded with solutions that also aren't restricted by borders. So I think that that's a very, very big challenge, and maybe that's enough because it's so vast. But definitely, I think we need to update the idea of democracy, our theories of democracy, to something which is more radical and that really addresses the more important issues that the population faces.
That was Sofia Rolim. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Fabio.
If you like our series, please share it with your friends on social media. they can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have comments or suggestions regarding the series or our project, drop me a note at fabio.isaiasilva@ou.edu.